Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security. We have a phenomenal topic today, post-quantum cryptography, diving into the crypto apocalypse and all the things we need to be prepared for in 2025, and respectfully, probably beyond. But I'm not going to answer those questions. We're bringing in an expert, Mr. Andy Smith. How are you, sir?
I am doing very well today. Thank you, Sean. Great to be on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Great to have you here. Andy, could you just give us a little bit of your background and some of the work that you've been doing in this space and your work in cybersecurity overall?
Yeah, sure thing. So I work as a security architect for a large energy firm at the moment. And one of the big things that requires me to do is be very up to speed with emerging technologies and what that means in the security context. So as you can probably guess, the past couple of years have been quite heavily AI focused. That's everyone's favorite buzzword topic at the moment. But one of the other areas where I've been having a particular focus over the past few years is around post-quantum cryptography. What does the arrival of quantum computers mean for us as security professionals, and what else should we be doing in order to safeguard our enterprises? What steps we'll take, and I'm sure we'll talk through a number of those things today. But outside of that role as a security architect, I also teach for SANS. I teach the 530 class, Defensible Security Architecture and Engineering. And I also have a little YouTube channel as well, where I occasionally post a little bit of cybersecurity content, but it's a little bit hit and miss.
Wonderful. Thank you, Andy. We'll get the your YouTube link, and we'll put that in the notes as well, so people can find
fantastic.
You. Fantastic. We'll do that at the end of the show. But fantastic. What we're looking at, though, Andy, is this question. We're now starting to see the vernacular of we should be thinking about moving to post-quantum. It should be in the mindset 2025. Is that the time you think that we should be moving? But let's start with kind of a generalization, if we could, Andy, and your thoughts on what is post-quantum cryptography and why should we be paying attention like you are?
Sure thing. So post-quantum cryptography is a bit of a catch-all term that refers to those cryptographic mechanisms that are designed to stay safe and secure even once the world has a sufficiently powerful quantum computer, or what we sometimes refer to as a cryptographically relevant quantum computer. After all, I'm sure yourself and many of your listeners have heard the kind of the news stories that once we get a sufficiently powerful quantum computer, it's going to break our existing crypto. It's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a doomsday type scenario. And so therefore, that post-quantum crypto are those mechanisms that are going to be able to stay robust and secure, even in the face of a sufficiently powerful quantum computer. And those solutions fall into a few different categories. Some of those solutions actually use quantum physics themselves in order to securely transfer keys, what's known as a quantum key distribution. Other solutions use proprietary algorithms that run on our classical computers that are quantum resistant. And then the main category of solutions, the ones that I'm a really big proponent of, are the new quantum resistant algorithms that NIST have recently standardized. So NIST, the National Institute for Science and Technology over in the US, have been running the standardization process, kind of like a competition to come up with some new algorithms that are based on mathematical properties that aren't going to be easily broken by a quantum computer. And we now have the first handful of those algorithms that we can start to use that are going to be quantum resistant.
Yeah, wonderful. It leads me to, NIST were, I'm not sure ahead of the curve, but we're preparing for a post-quantum world, which is good, right? We've got to be on that cutting edge, as it were. But when we start to think of how cutting edge do we need to be? So if we think of our current cryptographic systems that basically have vulnerability with quantum computing advancement, what are we looking at in terms of that we need to necessarily address in terms of symmetric or asymmetric sides of the house? And I think it's both, Andy, that require consideration. Is that right?
So both require some consideration, but the impact of a cryptographically relevant quantum computer does vary depending on whether we're talking about our symmetric or our asymmetric crypto. So with our symmetric cryptographic algorithms, those ones where we're using the same key for both encryption and decryption, they are vulnerable to a quantum computer running a Grover's algorithm. So Grover's algorithm, a particular quantum function, a quantum algorithm that's able to perform effectively a black box brute force search across a certain problem space. And Grover's algorithm provides a quadratic speed up over a classical computer. So what that means is something like AES 128 normally provides 128 bits of security. In the presence of a cryptographically relevant quantum computer, actually those bits of security are cut in half, so effectively only providing 64 bits of security. But what that means is, from a defender's point of view, if we want to regain that original level of security, we just need to double the key size. So instead of using AES 128, we use AES 256. So that's a relatively easy solution. When it comes to our asymmetric algorithms, those public-private key algorithms, things like RSA, things like elliptic curve crypto, Diffie-Hellman, they are vulnerable to Shor's algorithm, another quantum algorithm that runs on a quantum computer. But Shor's algorithm provides a exponential speed up over a classical computer. So that means we can't just pull the same trick. We can't just double the key length and that'll be it. We're going to end up losing as a quantum computer gets more and more powerful. So effectively, we need to recognize that, yes, our symmetric algorithms are at some level of risk, but the biggest level of risk is really those asymmetric algorithms. And of course, we use those asymmetric algorithms for encrypting our symmetric keys. We use them for authentication. We use them for digital signatures on code and firmware. So that public-private key crypto is used in many, many different places. And again, the impact of those keys or that encryption being broken is going to vary depending on how we're using crypto in each of those cases.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think, and with the PKI infrastructure, it's the, I'll not necessarily say the rush, but I think it adds an element of urgency to be prepared, right? It's from Louis Pasteur, chance favors the prepared mind. So we're preparing, right, in this space and working in this area. Now, when you're looking, and so we've got Shor's algorithm, Grover's, I know, I think a couple years ago, there was Schnorr's algorithm as well that was, reported to break RSA, and required a certain number of qubits with respect to the underlying system. We're starting to see a lot of media, sensationalizing certain capabilities in this space. We look at Google's Willow particular architecture with respect to quantum computing. And, we're talking septillion years, one with many, many zeros behind them, age of the universe is not even considered in these types of numbers. How do you feel that that either muddies the water of those that, you know, in your position, in my position, who are like, oh, we've got to future-proof the systems today, you know, they've broken it, that they're ready to go, whereas necessarily you do the research and you look into certain things, it's not really relevant. You know, we're not there yet. But where do you see that media element coming into play, and how do you feel that really is contributive to preparedness from an infrastructure perspective?
So I think it's good that we're seeing some media stories that are talking about quantum computers breaking crypto and post-quantum crypto. It starts to get some of that vernacular, some of that thinking going in people's minds, a bit of a share of that mind space. However, I would absolutely agree that a number of articles, the ones that seem to grab the most attention, are kind of sensationalized. You gave the example of the recent Willow chip. I remember seeing the same kind of sensationalized headline. I think it was on the BBC websites talking about this process that would take billions and billions of years. This chip was now able to do it in just a few moments. Oh no, is not the sky not falling now? Well, no, not really. Behind all of those big sensationalized headlines are the cold, hard truth. And in the case of the Willow chip, the particular metric, the benchmark, the code that they were running to come up with that amazing statistic is actually some relatively unuseful code. It doesn't have a huge amount of utility. It's designed to demonstrate a quantum advantage over a classical processor, but it doesn't do anything useful for us. Similarly, when we have seen stories in the past about, researchers have broken RSA using a quantum computer. Once you peel away the layers of that sensationalized article, we realize, oh, we're talking about 22-bit RSA. That's quite a long way short of, most folks, the minimum they're using today are 2048 bits. So we've still got a long, long way to go. So I always feel quite mixed. I think it's good to get people to start thinking about post-quantum crypto, but it can be kind of unhelpful when we kind of sensationalize the problem too much. I worry that we could end up into the boy who cries wolf type of situation where, there's a big disaster. We must look at addressing the quantum crypto challenge. Oh, actually, it's not a big deal after all. Repeat that 10, 20 times. No one's going to be paying much attention anymore, which is a shame because we do need to start acting now. I don't think we need to panic, but we do need to start making some sensible steps towards migrating now. Because ultimately, this is a multi-year, likely a multi-decade problem that we need to solve. Whilst we have some of the technical solutions now, we know some of those algorithms that we want to migrate to, some of those new NIST algorithms, actually achieving that, it's going to take a long time. If you think about all the different places in our software, our hardware, our firmware, our IoT devices, our cars, our industrial systems, where we've got elements of crypto, all of that needs to be replaced. And some of that is going to take a long, long line. Long, long time to do. So we better start planning for it now.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we think of that too, and again, a touch facetious, not really, Andy, but where I'm going is kind of the NIST start feels very academic. The mathematical proof of security, that's a lot different than an implementation capability of a technical application. And like you say, that takes time. That's not just, we'll throw it in some code and we're good to go, right? I think there's a need to understand that not only going through that vetting process is very important and obviously great shout out to NIST for the work, but I think then it's also the implementation, and even from a mathematically proven capability, its implementation can also introduce vulnerability. So how do you see that? I think you alluded to it just a moment ago, but how do you see that in terms of where are we talking, next year we should be seeing that as an available option in certain libraries to utilize that level of post-quantum capability? Or are we talking, this is probably 2-3 years down the line, but you maybe want to do a crypto bomb of your infrastructure, like a bill of material, and look where certain elements are to know where you need to make those changes. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, a crypto bomb, a bill of materials, or crypto inventory, 100%. That's one of the really fundamental and actionable things that individuals and organizations can start doing today. Because if you don't know how big the problem space is, if you don't know what you've got, you don't know then how long it's going to take you to address that, how challenging it's going to be. You don't know how to prioritize your different systems. So 100% definitely should be on the cards today. When it comes to the implementations of quantum resistant cryptography, we actually have those implementations in a number of cases already today. In fact, that's one of the big activities of that NIST standardization process. It was taking the theoretical maths and then translating that into how do we use that theoretical maths? What size keys do we use? What size parameters do we use in order to balance a certain level of security with a certain level of performance in terms of speed or CPU cycles or memory usage? And the output of all of that is the standards that NIST released in August of last year. And we have seen then a number of implementations. So the Boring SSL library that Google uses, that has some of those algorithms already baked into it. We see, I'm pretty sure there's one of the Microsoft-provided crypto libraries also now has some of those algorithms starting to be baked in. I know Cloudflare offer some of their services that use a quantum resistant key exchange mechanism as part of that TLS handshake. And in fact, within Chrome and Firefox, we already have some of those algorithms built in. So if you take your current normal version of Chrome that you're probably using right now and navigate to certain web pages that are hosted by Cloudflare, you're already using one of those quantum resistant algorithms. You're already using MLChem, which is one of the those new quantum resistant algorithms. So the implementations are here. It's just then the migration effort to take those libraries and to start using them across all of our software is going to be the real challenge. Because in most organizations, that's going to be split between the service providers we use, the cloud services that we depend upon. Well, we can't change that ourselves. We need to work with those vendors, work with those suppliers to say, can you start to support some of these newer algorithms? Where we as either individuals or organizations have built our own software, well, yeah, that's absolutely on us to then do some of that re-engineering to bring in some of those updated libraries and to re-engineer efforts for us. So it's going to be a very mixed set of activities, some very vendor focused, some more focused on us. And again, for me, one of the biggest challenges is where we have those hard to abate technologies, particularly things like IoT, things like industrial systems that we don't plan on changing for maybe 10 years, 20 years. I was having a conversation a year or so ago with someone who was working on smart meters. So smart electricity meters that get deployed out to people's homes, those don't get replaced for many, many decades, yet they have crypto in them as well. So a priority for organizations really has got to be looking for what are those technologies that are going to be hard to fix because you don't have an opportunity to update them easily or regularly, and also focusing on areas where we have particularly sensitive information that has a long period that it needs to stay sensitive for. Because if we've got information that needs to stay sensitive for, say, 20 years, well, that's going to be information that we want to move over to quantum resistant crypto sooner rather than later.
Yeah, no, that's great. Great point. It's good to see that we've moved in that direction, right? I think the path has been laid, but to your point, the shelf life of certain capabilities and certain libraries extend way beyond. And it's, you know, I was thinking, you know, do I liken it to SSL moving to TLS and you know, the versioning that we've gone through from 1.1 to 1.3? In some cases, there is analogous elements there, but with this type of capability, what you don't take into account there, that there's a whole new technological platform that representatively, mitigates the capability of what was implemented with those controls. And like you say, IoT, industrial control systems, those with archival and long-term requirement is, how are those replaced? Or do we put buffer between them necessarily in terms of an underlying infrastructure that is quantum hardened and then ultimately it then behind it can utilize non-post-quantum capability as a protective mechanism? You know, do we create another defense in depth layer in order to protect those until necessarily they're taken out of the supply chain? It's interesting because I think, you know, when others are looking at that, there's one, a return on the underlying investment. Hey, you know, it took us 15 years to even put the crypto library into it to begin with. And now you're telling me I have to go do it again. I'm not seeing the profits and cents in terms of doing that. But necessarily, I think it's about awareness. And then I think it's also, Andy, and I'd love to get your thoughts, is about being realistic with the approach. You know, when necessarily post-quantum, there's an actual sufficient quantum computer that moves to quantum supremacy and things of that nature, is smart meters its first target? Is it, we'll get into, well, I say we could go into, you know, Willow's multiverse type of approach and that it can do everything all at once in one clock cycle, but I'll digress there for a second. But I do think that there is a threat assessment as we start to see this availability, because necessarily a quantum computer is not just something, oh, you know, I'm going to swap out my Dell and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to go quantum Dell and you know, I'm just going to use it. Not necessarily the right use case, right? Quantum has a specific use case, and adversarially, we can think about that as well, that yes, there is an adversarial use case. But any thoughts in that space?
Yeah, sure. So I think probably one of the key things to recognize is that piece around a quantum computer is not a replacement for your current computer. They operate in a vastly different way. And there's many things that we do on our current breed of traditional computers today that a quantum computer would just be rubbish at. The analogy to think about here is a little bit like GPUs. We have a CPU, we have a GPU that accelerates graphics. Some machines now have NPUs, neural processing units that are designed to accelerate certain AI tasks. Well, quantum computing is going to be essentially the next thing along that sort of lines. It's going to be an accelerator to perform certain functions where there's a quantum advantage much, much quicker. We can't just take any of the code that's running on our traditional machines and just throw it at a quantum computer and it runs quicker. They're fundamentally different mechanisms of programming. So I think that really helps to inform that threat assessment, because fundamentally that's why the new breed of quantum resistant algorithms that NIST have standardized are considered to be quantum resistant, because they're based on a mathematical problem for which we don't believe there's any quantum algorithm that can speed up breaking that crypto quicker than just a traditional computer could by brute force. That all feeds into that kind of threat assessment of, okay, well, when do we start to act, right? When are we going to have a sufficiently powerful quantum computer, or again, a cryptographically relevant quantum computer? Chances are, once someone has a cryptographically relevant quantum computer, they're not going to tell anyone, because it's probably going to be a shady government agency that has access to this technology first, right? They want to be able to use it for kind of military and national security reasons. And okay, that makes sense. So what I suspect we'll see is at some point in the future, we'll see some cyber attacks that are attributed to nation states where there's a little bit of head scratching around, not quite sure exactly how they got in. And I'm sure it will be many decades later before we finally discover that maybe they had used a quantum computer to break some crypto as part of this attack chain. But like I say, us normals, we're not going to find out about that for long, long afterwards, right? So it then begs the question, okay, well, what should we as organizations do? Most of us don't work for the NSA or MI6 or those kind of government agencies. So do we really need to worry that much? Because again, chances are the first targets for this capability of cracking crypto with quantum computers is going to be in that kind of nation state space. For me, it very much depends on what type of organization we're talking about here. If you think about some private organizations are very much part of critical national infrastructure, so very much a viable target via a nation state attack. So, okay, maybe we want to prioritize some of those types of organizations, prioritize that critical national infrastructure, and again, that sensitive information that needs to exist for a longer period.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And I think it also, as we look at, like you say, that there's going to be that, I'll call it the watershed moment of the, how the heck did they do that? Oh, now I think I know, okay, now I think we see what's tracking. Let's see if we can forensically identify what occurred so we can replicate it ourselves. And anyway, that'll be for a discussion, like you say, for others in certain positions in government. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break.
Operating systems in the cloud are vulnerable to malware, misconfiguration, and more. That is, unless you securely configure them. Enter the CIS Hardened Images. These virtual machine images come pre-hardened to the CIS benchmarks, providing built-in security and compliance you can trust. Available at less than 3 cents per compute hour, CIS hardened images save you time and money managing your cloud security posture. Available on all major cloud service platforms. So spin one up today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you, and let's jump back into the episode.
The other thought is, and I think we can apply abstraction to this, but is people are thinking post-quantum is, well, now do I need to understand quantum mechanics in order to be able to apply and utilize? And it's, I think it's cool. I think there's something to learn, but I don't think necessarily you need to be a, understand the underlying quantum physics of the qubit or the, you know, coherence to allow superposition and entanglement and tunneling in order for you to go to a configuration, click a new library. Yep, we'll click the quantum one and we're done. Is, you know, that there starts to see respectfully a, you know, do we need to understand or think differently when we start to see quantum computers become part of necessarily the infrastructure? And it's an interesting question because, you know, I think, like you mentioned, certain organizations, I think once, you know, it's permeated government becomes something that is necessarily can be used for finance, for biomedical, healthcare, you know, different elements, is the institution of certain capability. You know, there's, if I remember some company, D-Wave, I think, you know, commercially offering certain types of quantum computers, because there's different flavors, right? I understand it correctly, Microsoft, you know, Amazon, IBM, Google, all providing their own flavor, as it were. But how do you feel that others would need to necessarily understand quantum infrastructure to be able to apply or protect such capability in the future? Is that something we should be, you better get, you know, get on that physics course right now, you know, physics 101 or quantum mechanics 101? Or is it, you know, let that permeate, let some of the academic and let that transition into more of abstraction, and ultimately you're just setting up an underlying infrastructure.
So I don't think that depth of understanding is needed at all. It's a little bit like how many people working in security understand how a arithmetic logic unit works. So the stuff deep inside a CPU that does addition and multiplication and subtraction. Do you know how that works and how the transistors are laid out?
Right.
Probably not. And you don't need to know that in order to secure the systems that we have today. And the same goes for using post-quantum crypto, particularly those NIST-provided algorithms. You don't need to know the details behind the horrendous maths. I've tried to read some of those mathematical papers, and my brain started coming out my ear very, very quickly. Really, really difficult to understand. The quantum physics properties themselves of entanglements and superpositions, they're all interesting. And I personally have been on a little bit of a learning journey over the past few years to understand a bit more about those. It's been quite insightful. But as you put it, as security professionals migrating to these newer quantum resistant algorithms, it's going to be a configuration item. It's going to be a change the library. It's going to be a select option B instead of option A. I would say there's a slight additional level on top of that when it comes to testing our security capabilities today and how well they understand some of those post-quantum algorithms. So, for example, where we might be undertaking things like TLS interception today, well, do our TLS interception capabilities actually speak that post-quantum crypto or not? If not, well, okay, we're going to lose visibility or we're going to break access to services. Similarly, when it comes to security monitoring, do our security monitoring systems understand some of those new fields that we're going to see in TLS headers and TLS handshakes? When it comes to code signing, do our code signing systems support those new algorithms, and so on and so on and so on. But certainly having that deep understanding of quantum mechanics, I don't think is necessary whatsoever, which I'm sure is music to many people's ears.
Exactly. I mean, like you, it's a journey of just self-discovery, as it were, to understand. And it's amazing what happens at the subatomic scale. But it's not going to make you any better necessarily as from a security perspective in that space. Andy, you know, final question is, what do you see, or what are you most optimistic about necessarily in terms of the future of cryptography in a post-quantum world?
I think really we can be quite optimistic because we know what the answer is. We've got those solutions now. We've got those standards. They're starting to be implemented by some of the big library providers. We've basically started that migration journey now. The starting gun has been fired. So we know what we need to do, which is much better than where we were a couple of years ago, where we had this big scary threat and the answer to what are we going to do about it was nothing. Just wait maybe another year or two for NIST to finish this standardization process, which is kind of quite uncomfortable. So I think we have the mechanisms now to start moving into that quantum era. But it means that we do need to start to take action ourselves, right? So in terms of undertaking that cryptographic inventory, starting to work out who's accountable for addressing crypto in different services, working with our vendors to make sure that our vendors have post-quantum in their roadmap. And I'd also say the flip side of that vendor piece is that if you are a vendor, if you are the maker of some software or particularly a security capability, if you can bake post-quantum crypto into that earlier than your competitors, well, there you go. That's a competitive advantage. That's something that certainly I know that I'm going to start looking for. It's going to start to be on my list of requirements when I'm assessing solutions. Does this solution support post-quantum crypto, or does this organization have a roadmap to be post-quantum crypto resistant within a certain time period. So I think there's lots of opportunity for us to start making a move now. So I'm less worried than certainly I was a year or two ago.
Wonderful. Andy, where can people find out about you and your work?
Yeah, so I can be found on the usual kind of social medias. I am at Rot169 on Twitter or X, on YouTube as well. That's probably where I post most. Also, LinkedIn. I'm sure we can include a few links in the notes for the show. So, I guess one of the things I'd signpost is a little mini series that I shared on YouTube about a year or so ago about quantum crypto, and basically that was me sharing my own learning journey that I went on. So, obviously, covers off a few of the things in more detail that we spoke about in this podcast. And I've got a few plans to maybe make a couple more videos on the topic now that the world has moved on a little bit, but not quite sure when that will be.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Andy. I guess I would make the suggestion of the new SANS course, that the post-quantum SANS course, but I'll leave that to you to develop. But thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing your expertise. And as we start to see movement in this space, love to have you back. We can talk about the evolution in this area as well.
Oh, that'd be perfect. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today, Sean. And yeah, more than happy to loop back around on that as things develop.
Wonderful. And thank you to the audience. Again, tune in every Wednesday for episodes like this and much, much more. Any questions or concerns, podcast@cisecurity.org. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.